That's Ray Bryant, if you ever heard of Ray Bryant. But if you didn't hear of Ray Bryant until now, that's him with Slow Freight, the title track of his 1967 album. And we had commentary there by Paul Serrano, who himself is a jazz trumpeter and audio engineer. Supposedly, he might have inserted all of this stuff, the commentary, while getting the album together. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, January the 6th. And we are 2 days away from the big day on Friday. I keep pumping this because I am excited about saying thank you to Dr. John Henrik Clark. And I'm hoping come Friday at 7 o'clock at Convent Avenue Baptist Church, where all good souls are meeting to say thank you so much, Dr. John Henrik Clark, for your lifetime service of retrieving for us the missing pages of our history and keeping us close to Africa, keeping Africa close to us, and showing us the way home. And that applies across the board, whether you are of African descent or not. The work of Dr. Clark lets us understand the importance and the centrality of Africa to world history and world events. And for that, we are saying thank you. It is on the occasion of his 100th anniversary of his birth. He is no longer with us. He left us in 1998, but before he left a treasure trove of information and history. And so we say thank you to him on Friday the 9th. So join us 7 o'clock at 145th Street and Convent Avenue Baptist Church. There'll be gospel music. There'll be major luminaries in the field of academia, historians themselves, and lots of grassroots organizations, and we're all getting together with a joyful spirit to say thank you to Dr. Clark. Well, today, no justice, no pleas. What does that mean? Well, it's a hint of where we're going. Yesterday, Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance said that a three-month-long investigation into charges by a female executive of the Reverend Al Sharpton's National Action Network, that she was sexually assaulted by the lawyer that Sharpton had selected to handle litigation in the Eric Garner case against the NYPD, Vance said that her charges were baseless and there was no indictment against Sanford Rubinstein. The case went without comment from Sharpton, which is very interesting, and we'll get to that. But Rubinstein said he was very happy that he was, quote, fully cleared, unquote. The case kind of reminds me of a case in 2012 when the same Cyrus Vance, the same district attorney, dismissed charges or would not bring indictment against Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who was the former head of the International Monetary Fund and a presidential hopeful in France. He was hoping to be elected president of France. But an immigrant, a housekeeper at a hotel where he was staying, had charged that she was sexually assaulted by him. And it turned out that Mr. Vance decided that she was the one who lacked credibility. And when the charges were not filed against Mr. Kahn on a criminal level, she took the matter in the civil court, filing against him in the Bronx. And rather than go through that trial, he settled the case for an undetermined amount, but some people say it was upwards of $6 million. The Rubinstein saga revives questions about the tactics that Sharpton and his legal teams have taken in two major cases that are at the root of the nationwide justice and anti-police brutality movements. And those two cases, as you know, are the chokehold death of Eric Garner in Staten Island and the shooting death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, both of them involving police. But let's talk about the first case first. And joining us is Keith White, who is co-counsel with Kenneth Montgomery in representing the National Action Network executive, whose name we don't know, but who had said she was sexually assaulted by Sharpton associate Sanford Rubenstein. And thank you so much, Mr. White, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, obviously you're not pleased with how things turned out. Could you tell us why?
Well, I mean, we think that, one, we believe our client. And so if we believe our client, then we think that the person who perpetrated the crime upon her should be tried in a court of law, and his fate should be decided by a jury of his peers. So that's the first reason why we're disappointed. Secondly, we're disappointed because the response from Rubenstein, his legal team, as well as from the Manhattan DA's office, seems to only embolden the privilege and the callousness that is present at the elite sector of society that empowers and emboldens this type of conduct that that they're accused of.
Well, let's take a look at the role of Cyrus Vance Jr. here. The district attorney's job, do you think that he had, going into this case, there was enough evidence on the face of it to warrant reasonable cause to have an indictment?
Well, I mean, so let's look at this holistically, right? And let's look at it from a couple of different perspectives. We believe that if the accused had been a poor person, a black person, a brown person, or any person that lacks privilege in this current American society, he would have been arrested and then investigated. And bail would have been set before he was able to get out and fight this case, right? So that's the first, you know, so we think that that obviously didn't happen here because Rubenstein is a man of power, privilege, and money. And his attorney is an attorney of power, privilege, and money, and also has very close ties with Cy Vance's office, where his partner's wife is, I believe, second in command at the DA's office. So I mean, there are a couple of other things to look at, right, when you look at the administration of the case. So then we get past that. There's the question of then you ask the question of whether or not there was enough evidence to bring the case. Well, one, there's a victim that says that she was raped and that she did not give consent to have sex with this man. She says she wakes up to bloody condoms all over the house, or all over the bedroom, and she's groggy, she feels drugged, right? And then you have drugs found in the apartment, you have bloody condoms, and the DNA matches her. So her story is corroborated with the physical evidence. She says that the only thing she had there at the house was some cookies that he gave her. The cookies that they find in the apartment actually are weed cookies. They actually have weed in them. They find other controlled substances in the apartment, right? So it corroborates that, you know, that she had a substance in her, and then the toxicology reports come back, and the toxicology reports, one, first of all, they were leaked, that it was leaked to the Post that toxicology came back clean, that she didn't have anything in her blood, and that was a lie. And, you know, And then we, you know, upon further investigation, they changed the story and they realized, no, the toxicology came back dirty, came back that there were drugs in her system, the same drugs that were found in the house. So all of these things at least raise the scepter of probable cause or reasonable suspicion. So was there enough evidence to bring the case? Of course. Was there enough evidence to indict? Of course. Was there enough evidence to even get a conviction? I mean, listen, if I was prosecuting the case, I would have felt confident in getting a conviction. So, I mean, what you're asking in terms of whether there was enough evidence, yes, in our opinion, there was enough evidence to bring this case.
Well, you pointed out some conflicts of interest here in the case. Did you move affirmatively about that before it got too late?
Well, honestly, it's not our power, or it's not our choice. We don't choose who the district attorney is when these cases are brought. The district attorney is an elected official, and so since the alleged crime happened in Manhattan, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office is the one who handles it. We don't choose venue when it comes to crimes.
No, but I'm saying, when were you aware of the conflict of interest with Benjamin Braffman, who is the attorney for Sanford Rubinstein, whose wife you say has
his partner's wife,
position.
Not his wife.
I'm sorry?
Braffman's partner's wife, not his wife.
Right, right. Braffman's partner's wife. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Did you know this going in, or did you find it out?
That's public information. There was New York Times did an article on the connection between that office and the district attorney's office last year or the year before last. So she's recused herself from certain cases.
All right, you're saying that if Sanford Rubinstein were an ordinary guy who did not have powerful friends and who himself was not a high-profile attorney, the normal course would be, upon the filing of the charges by the victim and upon corroborative proof that they had assembled initially, it would have been enough to begin the formal process of proceedings against him. But here we have the district attorney undertaking a 3-month-long investigation and conducting an investigation, in my view, in such a way as to suggest that the victim was the focus of his investigation and not the person she alleged.
You're right. I think you hit it right on the head. And the focus of the investigation was on the accused, was on the accuser, on the victim, and not on the accused. And you hit it right on the head. So they completely came up with excuses for every injury that she had. The bleeding, they blamed on something that's very common in women, but they're saying that occurred in her more than 10 years ago. They blamed the marijuana. They said that the marijuana that was found in the cookie in his house, that was found in her system after she said she ate a cookie, they said that she probably smoked marijuana after the incident happened, when she was very specific in saying that she does not do drugs, she doesn't smoke. So yeah, I mean, you know, everything that substantiates that this thing happened, they had an excuse for and a reason for. And then, you know, so we saw patterns, right? That kind of mirror. You mentioned the DSK case when you were leading into this interview. We saw patterns that remind us of DSK, right? In DSK, there was a leak.
And say DSK is Dominique
Strauss-Kahn.
Strauss-Kahn, yes.
Right. So there was a quote-unquote leak, right, that the victim in that case had went to speak with someone, and there was a transcription of that conversation where she was talking about money, and that was all over the news, right? But that wasn't true. And so you have the same type of leak, right, quote-unquote leak, where that says that the victim in this Rubenstein case was on the elevator kissing him and caressing him and all this other stuff, and that's not true. We've seen the surveillance footage of her and Rubenstein and her friend in the elevator. And they're arm in arm, they're hanging out, she pats him on the back, and that's the extent of their contact. There is no kissing. So you know, but the headline, that's not the headline, right? The headline is, oh, you know, she was apparently very touchy-feely with him and kissing him. And that's the headline that everybody buys into. But that's not the truth. And so what we have is we have a fundamental gap between what's being said in the press and the truth that's being released and imbibed by the public. You know, and that's an issue.
To your mind, is this a case of prosecutorial misconduct?
I will say that we are doing our own investigation, and we are moving forward, obviously, with the civil case, and we are exploring that as a possibility. You know, for me to say that it's a case of prosecutorial misconduct is a very strong statement, and I would think that Cy Vance, his office, and the people that work for him are smart enough to figure out ways to not be subject to that accusation. So we're not running around with that headline, and that's not something that we're trumping. You know, when we spoke to the district attorney's office yesterday, and they informed us, let me say this: when they informed us that they were not going to press the charges, they informed us 30 minutes after they informed the press. They informed us at 2 p.m. At 1:30, we were getting confirmed reports from the press that they were not going to press charges, and Brothman announced that he was having a press conference at 3 with Rubenstein. So, you know, I'm just going to lay that out there. But to the point, I'm sorry, what was your question?
I was asking whether this was prosecutorial misconduct.
Right.
In your view.
Right. So in our opinion, the case was not handled correctly. It was not handled appropriately, and it wasn't handled with sensitivity. However, I will say that Marsha Bashford, who was the chief who was assigned to this case, she was always pleasant. She was always nice, and you know, and I guess that felt good.
So is there no hope at all of this case proceeding around along the lines of criminal prosecution?
You know, we're not prosecutors anymore. So that's not something that we can't say that. The Manhattan DA's office would have to say that. The case is, you know, the case is not closed, but they've decided not to pursue it any further. So whether or not they open it back up, whether some new evidence comes up, I don't know.
But can you compel them to open the case again? Is there some legal recourse that you can take to compel a second examination of this case on criminal grounds?
The victim in this case is a civilian. She can only say what happened to her, and she can only repeat it as you know, as much as they'll hear it. But we can't legally sue them to pursue a criminal action. We can't. That's not how this system works.
I'm curious about how you interpret the role of Reverend Alfred Sharpton here in this case. Sanford Rubenstein is somebody he has been affiliated with for a long time. In other cases, he has appointed or caused to be appointed Mr. Rubenstein to be the legal counsel in other high-profile cases, most notably the case of Abner Louima, who was violated by a group of police officers in a precinct, and it was a notorious case. the fact that Al Sharpton basically said nothing and indicated that there might have been reason to believe that this was not a rape case per se, but he kind of suggested that he didn't know what had happened. He wasn't there. He has no say in the matter. And now, after the decision by the district attorney, he also has nothing to say. And yet, this is an executive within the National Action Network. How do you interpret Sharpton's actions?
Well, let me say, she's not an executive at the National Action Network. That's also not true. She's on the board of the National Action Network. And so she's an executive at a much larger private for-profit enterprise. So she serves on the board at the National Action Network. Now, with regard to Sharpton and him saying that he was not there, as far as we know, he wasn't there. And him saying that he doesn't know if this happened or not, as far as we know, he doesn't know. So I can't cast any aspersion upon him for not choosing a side. Honestly, the Al Sharpton conversation or narrative with regards to this case is a distraction for us. This case is not about Al Sharpton. This case is not about whatever they have set up, whatever type of thing that they have set up, where Rubenstein was able to get all these cases in these poor communities. That's not what this case is about. This case is about a woman who says that she was victimized, and then she's victimized by the system because the system doesn't serve her justice. And then she's re-victimized in the public because then her accusers, the accused's attorney is threatening to sue her for defamation for fighting for her rights. So that's what this case is about for us, and that's what we're focused on.
I just want to ask you one more question as we continue here. Mm-hmm. You've cast the case in the context of privilege and power, mm-hmm. but you have astutely avoided the question of race. To what degree has race played a major role here, and do you see a parallel between this case, the Tawana Brawley case, and the Dominique Strauss-Kahn case, where the woman from Guinea, Nassif, I keep mispronouncing her name. Nassifatu Diallo had accused this powerful man, mm-hmm. white man, of raping her.
Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure about the Tawana Brawley case. I was very young when that happened, and I've never really been able to understand or get a resolution on what happened. I only know that that there was no prosecution on that case. With regards to Dominique Strauss-Kahn, I think that this case is similar to that. It's similar to the Greg Kelly case where there was no prosecution. And the distinctions are drawn between the Moreno, the Tony Simmons cases where when you talk about race, I think that race is a factor, but I think that any conversation on race is unfair without a conversation on economics, because race and economics have gone mm-hmm. hand in hand in American society since the 1600s when the first judicially recognized slave owner was a black person named Anthony Johnson. So the reason why we're saying this case is about privilege and is about power is because sometimes race gets mixed up in that equation, and it can be a very confusing thing. And so what we've done is we've also said, well, where is the National Organization of Women? Where are these other organizations that are coming at and attacking Bill Cosby, this man of power, right? Where are they at on this case? Because this is happening now.
So what lies ahead?
What lies ahead is we filed a civil suit, and we're going to, our goal in filing a civil suit is to litigate and to make a statement that these types of actions won't be tolerated and that women's rights should be respected regardless of who the accuser is and who the accused is.
Well, I want to thank you, Keith White, for joining us today, giving us some behind-the-scenes information about this case. And we'll be following it up. And thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the Brown and Garner cases suggesting that accommodation, not litigation, is the priority. Right after this. You're listening to PRN.FM, and you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead. The Rubenstein saga, as I said, revives questions about the tactics of Sharpton and his legal teams, who have been assigned to two major cases that are at the root of nationwide justice and anti-police brutality movements. And those two cases, as you know, are the Eric Garner chokehold death on July the 17th of last year in Staten Island, and the shooting death of Michael Brown on August the 9th in Ferguson, Missouri. Well, of course, we've begun a new year, and we are seeing some very disturbing things. I've talked about it before, and now we see that there seems to be proof. And it was just conjecture, but it seems to be proof now that the main concern in these two cases in particular is accommodation, not litigation. What do I mean by that? These cases came to symbolize a troubling pattern and a troubling history in the United States of police force and excessive and lethal force directed at people of color across the nation. Most often, they are African-American men and Latino men. And most often, the killings, the police killings, are done by white police officers. Well, we saw what happened in Ferguson, Missouri. A lot of tra-la-la, a lot of drama, a lot of cameras and news conferences and having community meetings and rallies and demonstrations galore that led to absolutely nothing. And I said then, and I'm even more convinced now, that the whole thing was a kind of contemptuous exercise. Contemptuous in the sense that in the mind of Al Sharpton, who has anointed himself as the king of the blacks and has managed to convince a certain sector of America that he in fact is, because everybody's going to him in the racist, stereotypical way of thinking that black people, unlike everybody else, need some messianic character to express their thoughts and their will. And so the embodiment of black feeling about anything is planted firmly in one person. And all you have to do to find out what is going on with black folks is you find that one person, the leader. And through the leader, you not only get to know what's happening, but you also get to know how to control what is happening. And that was what he signed up for. Al Sharpton signed up for duty as the political operative of the Democratic Party, playing all sides. And here in Ferguson, we saw that he played that role to a T. There has yet to be a call from Al Sharpton, and not just a call by announcing it into a microphone at a news conference, but showing proof of determination for justice by filing or litigating it, showing a signal to the state apparatus that it is in for a fight. There's no fight in Sharpton on this count. There's no fight in his attorneys. All this is about is raising the ante, raising the specter of a larger payout. And you can get a larger payout in terms of a settlement if you behave yourself. You act like you're angry, and you get a whole bunch of people out in the street clamoring for justice. But that is used really not to extract justice from the system. It is not used to back up a legal strategy for justice, but it is used to demonstrate to the powers that be, look what I can do if you don't pay me well. I can get these people to march against you. I can rally hundreds and thousands of people and make life a bit uncomfortable for you, public relations wise. So it is in your interest to sit at the table and let us both agree, both sides. We will sit down from across from each other at the table, and we will discuss what the value, the monetary value is of a dead Eric Garner and a dead Michael Brown. And you will throw out a figure, and we will throw out a figure, and we will come to terms. And whatever that figure is, and it would be in the millions, because these cases and the circumstances of these cases suggest that there isn't going to be much of a fight on the part of the city. This is not going to be a long involved litigation. There's practically no litigation involved. It's just a matter of waiting and coming to terms. And behind closed doors, they will agree on the value of the dead men. I called these folks before collectors of bones. That's what they do. That's the industry they have spawned, and that's what they profit from now. They're in the business of making money on dead men's bones. In the case of Eric Garner in New York City, all these things have happened without comment, without involvement, without action, legal action from Sharpton and his so-called legal team. We talked about the fact that Daniel Pantaleo, the officer identified, and he should have been one of several targeted for prosecution, that he has already appeared for questioning within the police department. That is to say, the process of the police investigating itself has gone on without comment, without involvement, without oversight, without litigation from Sharpton and his team. In Ferguson, Missouri, we had a district attorney deciding that he was going to invent a hybrid grand jury. We'll be talking about that tomorrow, incidentally. A hybrid grand jury, something nobody ever knew. What was this beast that he presented to the public as a grand jury? And it was doing all kinds of things that grand juries are not really empowered to do. And naturally came up with the required result of no indictment. We had a similar farce occurring in Staten Island, where the district attorney there did exactly the same thing, and yielding exactly the same result, and without comment, without interference, without oversight, without any legal objection by Sharpton and his crew. So what does this mean? It means they are not in the business, they are not really interested in engaging the system at all. They're interested in negotiating with it. They're interested in coming to terms with it. And they're interested strictly in the payout. That's all. Give us the money that we want, and we good. But in order to get the money, the deal is they have to behave themselves, and they have to persuade the community to behave. Yeah, you could get out there and, you know, on cue, on command, when Sharpton raises the flag and says, okay, I need 10,000 people in the street and 10,000 very sincere people, people wanting change, people really motivated by the horror of injustice, they obey and they show up and they have no clue whatsoever that they actually are a mockery to themselves and to the issue that they ostensibly are demonstrating for. The reason that they're demonstrating has nothing to do with the real motivation for the demonstration. They're there simply to shore up the demand for more money from the system. And since they have to sit across the table from the same people that they have to negotiate with, they have to show that they've done everything possible to quiet the natives, to keep them under control, to control the anger and the direction of their movement, which is why, of course, it was so incredibly refreshing to see people just move that leadership out of the way, because it isn't leadership at all. It's a con job. And these lawyers, I have to say, and Sharpton, this year must not escape responsibility for the fact that these cases were put purposely on the wrong track so as not to yield the desired result of justice. There is no interest in justice. If there were an interest in justice, we would have heard very early in the game that Sharpton and his legal team have filed lawsuits against the respective states demanding a special prosecutor. I said that very early. And I'm not a lawyer, but I've covered these cases long enough to know how the system typically would respond. And you would imagine that Sharpton, who has walked around this block several times, knows exactly what the system is likely to do. And because he is an expert in this arena, one would expect an expert response. He would be proactive, and the lawyers would have taken the appropriate measures to head the state off at the pass so that they don't go down that predictable route. And, of course, they did, because there was no interference. There was no objection. There was no countervailing point of view. There were no legal papers that said, you may not proceed down the predictable path. We know what you are likely to do. And here is our legal lawsuit, saying you're not going to do it and get away with it. We are with you. We are on top of you every step of the way. We're watching you. We know who you are. We know what you are likely to do. No such thing. Alton Maddox on this program made an extremely important point. Well, he made many, many important points, but this one in particular, that the cases were transmuted into what essentially is a personal injury type case rather than a class action lawsuit, where Eric Garner and Michael Brown would have been the stand-ins or the symbols of the plight of African-American men and Latino men across the board. They are, in fact, symptomatic and emblematic of a class of people who historically have been subjected to these kinds of lethal treatment by police over a long period of time. And therefore, naturally, these cases should be class action lawsuits, acting in the interest of the people, the public, all of us. Now, that requires that you take an entirely different approach to these cases, and you spend the time and effort and energy in putting together the legal strategy for bringing these kinds of cases on a class action basis. What these folks have decided to do, and they've been very slick about it, is that they have transformed what should be class action cases into personal injury actions. So that each case is separate. You know, the Eric Garner case is separate from the Michael Brown case. And separate because they are individual actions of personal injury. And why? Because the lawyers are personal injury lawyers and have no clue as to how to proceed with a case of this nature. So they're operating within their professional safety zone, which is personal injury. So the case can only be about personal injury. You see? And out the window, completely outside the sphere of consideration, is the implication on the class action level. All of this energy, all of these protests are really to shore up the demand for a big payout at the end. And of course, they get a good cut of that, upwards of 33%. Justice, doesn't pay. What are they going to get from a justice determination here if these cases were litigated as justice issues? Doesn't pay. Doesn't pay. So we have to be really clear about this. And we have to call them out about it. And we have to determine that we are not going to be played like this anymore. They've run the course. They've gone on to other people's bones. They've added other cases, the same thing, and the same tactic. No interest at all with respect to justice. All about the cash and the payout, the money. That's how they make their bones, by standing on other men's bones. It's contemptible. Meanwhile, Sharpton gets a lot out of this. Although indications are that he's increasingly going to be facing some hardship because they're looking at him more closely than he expected. He thought that by allying himself to Barack Obama, becoming a very important operative of the Democratic Party, by being the go-to guy, the king of the blacks, that this would kind of thicken the shield of protection around him, but it's not holding, is it? It's quite permeable, and he's getting a lot of signals that there are holes in the armor. The thing that you learn after a while is that no matter where you locate yourself on the map, if you lose sight of the idea as to what your mission ought to be. If you make an industry of people's pain and suffering, it necessarily means you have to accommodate yourself. It means that you have to betray. It means that you are a charlatan. You're dishonest. And you should be shunned. Because in the end, such people are the betrayers of a long history of struggle. They profit individually, or they seek to profit individually, but it is at the expense of the whole body of people who are experiencing great misery in their lives, great injustice. Where would we be as a people, even as a society, without the struggles, the sincere struggles of people to humanize the society and to deliver justice? Where would we be? Where would we be if people like Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks or Harriet Tubman or David Walker, what would we be if they were compromisers and accommodationists and people who profited from other people's pain? That's a very serious question. And what is the appropriate response when we discover that there are people doing this and fulfilling this nefarious role in front of our own eyes, and without even blinking at the idea that there is not going to be any repercussion? Where would we be? So this year is a year of accountability, it seems to me, and we should be asking of these lawyers, because, you see, justice, the struggle for justice, necessarily requires an entirely different approach. Either they are incapable of it, they don't have the capacity for it, they don't have the experience, the professional experience to involve themselves that way, or they don't care. Either way, no matter which way you look at it, it is required that they should step up to the plate just the same. If your strength, for example, is personal injury law, it means then litigating against the state is not your specialty. Then it seems to me that you would necessarily reach out to people for whom this is a specialty, so that when these cases arise, there is a comprehensive response. We know on one end there should be compensation. That's part of the law. This is not something new. But it can't be the only response. And it can't be the only response if, in fact, the intention is to secure justice. You have to engage the state. Who is doing that on Sharpton's so-called legal team? Who is confronting the system? And then you have to engage in legislative action in order to get so-called reforms. Who is your legislative guy or person? That may be appropriately non-sexist. Who is your person dealing with that? And then you have to have somebody dealing with police operations. Who's an expert in that? Well, who is your police operations expert? You just had a departmental hearing occur in which the police commissioner himself has taken on the job, the legal job of a judge. And nobody's watching. Nobody's guarding the house here, which means they're not interested in it. So we have to make certain determinations, and then we have to demand accountability on these things. We can't let them go. There's been too much invested, even before the killing of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. There's been too much invested, too much misery experienced, too much pain and suffering caused. And now in the aftermath of their deaths, or with their deaths, we have even more. So we have to insist that our leadership be forthright, that it has the credentials to transact business in our name, or it should go away. Fold up your tent, fold up your personal injury tent, and go away. If this is a private case, deal with it in private. Do not involve the community. Do not ask for their participation or involvement. Deal with it in private, with your private self, in the private firm, and your private transactions, and leave it at that. But don't tell us. Don't even think of telling us this is about justice. I want to thank you for joining me today, and I hope that the program caused us to think about some things that we have an entirely different accounting of in major media. And of course, that's the reason for this program, that you get an entirely different point of view. And I close again. I am urging us all, because I think it is a duty that we have, to honor our elder. And he is indisputably an elder, Dr. John Henry Clark. And I'm hoping to see all of you at Convent Avenue Baptist Church on Friday the 9th at 7 p.m. Things get started with a boom. And the boom will come from traditional African drumming as we honor this great man who has, and he's in the pantheon of scholars who did everything. They devoted their entire lives to our knowledge of ourselves. And for that, we must say thank you. But because this is his 100th anniversary year, we are doing a special thing and starting the year off right, with the right mind and the right spirit, and saying thank you, Dr. John Henry Clark, Convent Avenue Baptist Church at 145th Street and Convent Avenue. We have Dr. Leonard Jeffries and Rosalind Jeffries and Camille Yarbrough and Alton Maddox and a whole long list of people who will be talking about the importance of this man. And right there, we will dedicate ourselves to perpetuating his work, because it is so necessary, especially in this day and age. And I am privileged to convene everybody, and I'm delighted. You have no idea how pleased I am to be involved in this most incredibly important event. So thank you so much. A pleasure and a privilege to be in your company. Tomorrow we'll be talking about the Ferguson case in particular and related issues. Bye-bye.